At some point around the 60s, we stopped thinking like people, and we started thinking like... yeah. Okay, so this isn't the whole point of the video, but I do want to show you a quick graph. It's the use of the sentence, marketplace of ideas, over time. You can see that around the mid-60s, that sentence just took off. And this makes sense, right? I looked it up on the most authoritative platform I know, Wikipedia, and the first use of free trade in ideas was only in 1919. The first verbatim marketplace of ideas was 34 years later. And it's only a decade after that that it became official policy in Brandenburg v. Ohio in 1969. That timeline is obviously a big reason for the boom happening when it did. But there's something more to this story. I'm not showing you this graph so I can talk about the metaphor itself. It's not a fantastic metaphor for a ton of reasons, which I think are pretty obvious. The myth of the marketplace of ideas, that truth somehow always wins when every single opinion, no matter how horrible, is put out there, is just obviously not true. Ideas don't really compete in a competitive or level playing field. People don't really assess ideas like their products. The idea that truth always comes out on top is laughable. And just in general, you probably already know that the people who use this sentence pull it out almost exclusively to say bigoted stuff. Right? Lots of problems there. Whatever. It is interesting that this metaphor has become so widespread despite its problems, but what I find more interesting about this graph is that it's getting at something deeper. The total takeover of economic-ish language and ideas about how we make decisions. Something that started in the 60s, but then quickly snowballed to where we are today. It's clearly become very fashionable to think like an economist over the last half century. Without looking too hard, you can find people talking about things like supply and demand and game theory.
Game theory!
On just about any topic, from politics and public policy, all the way down to, frankly, quite creepy stuff about, like, the dating market. That's interesting, and it's weird. Why did thinking like an economist take off, but thinking like an anthropologist, for example, never did? We'll get to why, but first, it's pretty clear that this trend has made life worse for most of us. Because if it wasn't obvious from the last 100 videos already, neoliberal economists tend to be assholes. But first, it's ad read time because I've got to pay my bills. Let me show you something real quick. Google your name. I know you have to open another tab or switch apps. Just do it real quick. Odds are some of your personal information comes up, right? If I search my name, it's just my public social media accounts. Wanna know why? Because I use Aura, the sponsor of today's video. If you've ever wondered why you're constantly harassed by spam calls, texts, and emails, here's why. There are companies called data brokers whose sole purpose is to find and sell your data. They do it without your consent, and they make billions selling it to marketers, scammers, and even stalkers. And while they're legally required to remove your info if you ask, they make the process confusing and difficult on purpose. This is why I'm always recommending Aura to family and friends. They take care of everything for you. They remove your data from these sites, and they keep it removed. Aura is an all-in-one digital security tool. You may already use some other basic app, but not using Aura is like locking your front door, but leaving your back door wide open. And Aura doesn't just fight data brokers. They alert you if your personal data is found on the dark web, they provide real-time fraud alerts for credit and banking, 24/7 identity theft monitoring, a secure VPN, antivirus, parental controls, password manager, credit checker, and more. And if somehow anything does happen, Aura includes $5 million in identity theft insurance, and they have US-based fraud experts on call 24/7. If you're anything like me, I'm sure you're sick and tired of these stupid, evil little companies stealing your personal information and using it to make a quick buck. That's why I use Aura. It keeps me and my family safe online. If you're ready to protect your data, you can get 2 weeks absolutely free when you use my link. During those 2 weeks, you'll see exactly where your data is being leaked and who's doing it. Give it a try. I promise you'll appreciate the peace of mind. Now, back to the show. You've heard of the prisoner's dilemma before. If not, just picture this. You are one of two prisoners kept in a jail in separate cells. The warden gives you a choice: confess to your crime and rat out your partner, or stay silent. If you confess and your partner doesn't, you walk out scot-free. If you both confess, you both serve 5 years. If neither of you confesses, you both only get 1 year. But if he confesses and you don't, you'll be the one spending 10 years in jail while he gets to go free. What should you do? For the mathematicians at the Rand Corporation who created this thought experiment in the 50s, the rational answer for this standard one-shot of the prisoner's dilemma is to rat out the other guy, no matter what. Assume selfishness and be selfish yourself. After all, in most scenarios, ratting the other out will make you better off. And odds are, the other guy is thinking the same thing because the same is true for him. If you want, you can do some math using the numbers I gave you earlier and put them into a table like this to calculate exactly what the expected number of years in jail is for every action. The Nash equilibrium, which is usually considered the quote-unquote optimal solution for this setup, is to confess. Even though the best collective outcome is for both people to stay silent, each person's best choice is to confess. Now, there have been a ton of variations on the prisoner's dilemma. A set number of rounds versus an infinite number. Different payouts for confessing or being quiet, swapping freedom and jail time for prize money or torture. Different numbers of players. Different options than just the standard two. People have messed with it quite a bit, and all these variations can give you different optimal strategies and results.
Tonight you're all going to be a part of a social experiment.
Each of you has a remote. Blow up the other boat. If, however, one of you presses the button, I'll let that boat live. So, who's it gonna be?
But at its inception, the game was meant to reveal something basic and fundamental about humans and how we make decisions. In all of its many iterations, the prisoner's dilemma states that if we just act selfishly about what our expected gains are, we are mathematically rational. It doesn't say you can't cooperate, but it always considers the value of cooperation from the point of view of maximizing the individual's own personal gain. The game always measures what you are doing as rational by whether or not your expectations of reward are as high as possible. Even in versions of the game where the quote-unquote mathematically optimal strategy is to prefer cooperation. The thing is that this isn't actually telling us anything about our decision-making process. In real-world experiments of the game, people chose the unoptimal strategy all the time, which economists can't explain, so they just call people idiots. But that's because this rationality the game theorists came up with isn't reality. It's a normative claim on what our decision-making process should be. And you can probably already see why there might be some problems with basing rationality on something like the prisoner's dilemma. For one, this game is not meant to have you ask questions like, what if I care about more than the number of years I'll spend in jail? What if I care about the other guy or due process? What if I care about the feeling of betrayal? What commitments do this other person and I have to each other? What if there are social conventions in place that change our expectations about what the other person's gonna do? Or at a very basic level, what if we could just talk? Those questions are designed to be outside the game. Plenty of real-world evidence shows that people think about stuff like that in situations like the prisoner's dilemma, and that different cultures have different approaches to life than just trying to maximize their own personal gain. But on paper, the name of the game is how do you get the fewest years in jail possible, and nothing else. And that would be fine if the prisoner's dilemma was just a mathematical experiment. But it's not.
And here we go.
Like the marketplace of ideas, the prisoner's dilemma and the rest of the field of game theory that it's inspired is one of those things that became wildly popular during the mid-20th century. Especially in economics, where most of microeconomics actually changed how it understands value to be similar to the approach used in the prisoner's dilemma, something called expected utility theory. Essentially, because of game theory, economists now assume that people make decisions based on their expectations of getting the best possible outcome for themselves. That wasn't always the case. And since value is probably the most foundational thing in economics, changing that means changing almost everything at once. And it's not just econ. Game theory and exercises like the Prisoner's Dilemma are taught in math departments, political science, sociology, psychology, and environmental studies. Philosophy departments offer courses in logic that heavily rely on game theory. It's been used to study animal behavior and even bacterial organisms. It has even become the metaphor for why countries don't act on climate change after the Stern Review came out in 2006. Formulas developed by game theorists now inform many of our big political decisions. This has had a profound effect. It's reframed rationality to something very specific: expected individual gain. Despite the fact that the Prisoner's Dilemma can be challenged on empirical and theoretical grounds, for not including enough, for making wild assumptions about how humans think, or the fact that rational choice theory is also essentially tautological, it defines rationality as people choosing based on their preferences. So, by definition, every decision that actually occurs is rational. Brilliant work, really. Truly amazing stuff. And yet, it still took over all these disciplines and aspects of our lives. So now when we think about politics and elections, it's through this specific framing of rationality. And who can blame us? A ton of work is done by pollsters and data scientists and media strategists to find the way to sell a candidate to the public so that the greatest number of people feel like they're maximizing their utility by voting for one guy over another, and to maximize mutual distrust and increase the stakes of rejecting a cooperative alternative. In public policy, too, we now analyze political motives and policies not through what is the best collective social outcome and process, democratic debate, and the respect of all people's personhood, but instead through the best possible way to create the conditions in which any one person could technically maximize their own selfish ends, regardless of what that means for others. We put ourselves in the shoes of the guy just trying to look out for himself. Others are no longer entitled to respect, safety, or other considerations that escape the narrow border drawn around me and my family. All they're entitled to is the right to defend themselves from our selfishness too. As if there was no society, just people duking it out. The problem is that this objectively sucks, and the real world isn't like that. This hyper-individualism is a race to the bottom because it makes the very idea of the common good seem like an irrational choice. Those who developed game theory and its policy offshoot, public choice theory, these guys, even went so far as to argue that the mathematical methods could be used to prove that there's no such thing as the common good in the first place. They transformed the way we think about politics, as if it's a marketplace in which we are completely selfish individuals, entering to maximize only our own gain when we vote for someone or greenlight a policy. And because they were staunch defenders of American capitalism during the Cold War, they made it their mission to develop this so it would make complete violent selfishness synonymous with reason. They based their ideas of justice not on the agreements people make in a democratic process, a method far too irrational and unmathematic, and instead justice became redefined as how do we get the biggest expected utility possible. And since we can never actually measure utility directly, the only thing left to judge policy on was if it gave someone the possibility of becoming an uber billionaire, regardless of how many lives we ruin or acres of rainforest we burn to get there. The expected value of the ends justify the means. This is how we were left with neoliberalism, with gutting public housing, education, childcare, and healthcare so that middlemen could get richer, siphoning off more of our money when things go private. Wealth redistribution from the top was out of the question, since, oh, just look at the table, the oh-so-important incentives would just never be as good for our great selfish billionaires. But it is so obvious that making the world a place where everyone is in the same race to become a billionaire, where collective distrust and maximizing individual returns with no concern for how many people need to be stomped on to do so, means destroying everything. Destroying the possibility that everyone can thrive. We don't all need to have the hope of becoming billionaires to be happy. But we live in a world of billionaires getting out of jail free while everyone else is slowly chiseling away at their 10 years. This is what neoliberalism was built on formulas that claim they can prove what we ought to do, sneaking past us the assumption that our only goal should be coming out on top. But people don't actually think the way these models say they do. people in the real world often make decisions collaboratively, selflessly, with different goals in mind, acting inconsistently and with more than one preference, caring about process and not just outcomes, and certainly not just themselves. This isn't irrational. It isn't inefficient. It is capital G, good. It is what keeps us in community. Nothing is ever like the models. So why try to build a society where even the models suck?